This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Amor Towles. He's the author of a book called Rules of Civility. It's a novel set in New York, 1938. And I will preface by saying I've read a lot of books this year. This is by far my favorite book of the year.
Thank you.
Absolutely stunning book, and I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you about it, Amor. So maybe we could just start by, you know, setting the scene. The main character of the book is a young woman. Well, at the beginning of the book, she's not a young woman, but we have this scene where I guess it would be, what, early 60s?
Mid-60s, yeah.
Yeah. And she and her husband are at an art gallery, a show of photographs. And she sees this guy, and that's kind of the mechanism by which you transport us back to 1937, 1938.
Yeah, and the setup that you're describing is in essence a historical event. Obviously, she's an invented character, but Walker Evans, the great American photographer, who's most especially known for the photographs he did in conjunction with Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, the pictures of the Dust Bowl individuals and the Deep South rural families, in the late 1930s, he rode the New York City subways with a hidden camera and took portraits of the people sitting opposite him without their knowledge. And he took hundreds of these portraits over a three-year span. And in history, he, in looking at those photographs, determined that he had invaded the privacy of the individuals and he wouldn't show them. And in the mid-1960s, the Museum of Modern Art in New York convinced him that enough time had passed, you know, close to 30 years, that he should be willing to show them at that point. And so they were shown publicly for the first time at that moment. And the opening scene is at the opening of that show, and a sophisticated woman from the Upper East Side with her husband in her late middle age is going through the show and recognizes an individual, an acquaintance of hers from the past, in the photograph and in the photographs. And in seeing that initial picture, he is looks young, vibrant, but poor, ill-shaven, in a threadbare coat, because it is a flashback to the Depression, the pictures are. And having told her husband, I knew this man, they move on through the show, and she sees the second photograph of a man who looks a little bit older and more world-weary, in a cashmere coat, and she says that this is the same individual, that this is him. And the husband surprised and says, well, at least he got back on his feet. And she says, she points, no, actually, this is the earlier photograph. The one that looks older and more world-weary and wealthier is the one that was taken before, the one where he looks younger and vibrant but poor. And that's really sort of, as I say, the premise of the book, that the show, the photographs are real, and you can actually go to amortolles.com and link up to the Metropolitan Museum and go through hundreds of the actual portraits, which are quite ghostly in a fascinating way. I mean, they're really an amazing document. But when I originally saw those photographs in my mid-20s, I'm 46 now, in going through the photographs in book form, I was struck with this notion. What if somebody recognized somebody at the show? And as I continued to go through the photographs, it sort of occurred to me, wow, what if the person recognized the same person twice and the person had undergone a transformation? And in the way of such things, I kind of wrote that down in the back of a matchbook and threw it in a box. And half the time when you bring that matchbook back out of the box, I can't read my writing. But in this case, setting out to write a book in 2006, I was looking for, going through some of my old ideas and stumbled on that idea from 20 years before, and launched the project. The book, as you point out, doesn't really take place in 1960s. That's in essence the opening. The book really opens then on the last night of 1937, when the main character and her roommate, her boarding house roommate, are in a sort of a low rent jazz club in the village, and the young man in a cashmere coat comes in and sits at the table next to them, and they strike up a conversation, and they're decide to spend a couple of days together, kind of banding about as a threesome, and that sets in motion a series of events, a chain of events, really, that in essence, takes the lives of all three of them in new directions, sends their lives kind of veering in directions that were unanticipated by virtue of that, the events that unfold in that calendar year of 1938.
Right. It is throughout the book, there are these kind of accidental meetings. And I think that that sort of is a theme of the book. And I think the way I'm sort of interested in, I mean, obviously it is what happens to many people, but I think you've kind of, you know, as with any maybe a piece of art or fiction, there's a compression, you know, and a heightening of elements so that
yes.
You know, you're kind of emphasizing the power of accidental meeting, and also that the characters take the opportunities when offered to them.
That's right.
I think that's important. I mean, you're not trying to teach a lesson. I don't mean it in that way. But if you wanted to read it as, you know, kind of a directive, you know, for how to live, it would say, you know, you might say, well, when you're presented with these kind of what seem to be mundane but interesting opportunities, better to take them than to go home and sit by the fire.
Yeah, I that's fair, and I also think, because I do agree with you in your description of that aspect of the book. I also just I think it's very true to that time in one's life. Today, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you take someone in their early to mid 20s. Now that's what the characters are, kind of when they bump into each other, and every year still. Tens of thousands of 25-year-olds are arriving in New York City with their ambitions, and some maybe they're in a training program, maybe they don't have a job, maybe they're trying to make it as an artist or in a band or in fashion or what have you. But they arrive, and over the course of a couple of years, it feels very willy-nilly. You get a roommate, you meet the roommate's old. Schoolmates. One of the schoolmates then has a girlfriend. You meet the girlfriend. You meet the girlfriend's roommate, and you do get a job, and you actually hit it off with one of the other interns, and you get to know them and their circle of friends. It's very loose form, and you get invited to go to a gallery opening, or you go to a bistro and share a steak because you can't afford it yourself, or what have you. But at the time, it kind of feels directionless in this great way. It's very spontaneous. It's very haphazard. There's a lot of chance aspects to it in terms of who you, the fact that you went to that dinner that night is the reason you met that person across the table. But in retrospect, somewhere along the march of these sort of fun, unorganized events, as it were, some decisions start to get made that have lasting influence. Suddenly, that third job that you take is your career for the next 30 years, and that seventh relationship you're in is your spouse, and you know the third apartment you live in is the neighborhood you're actually going to stay in. And we don't know when that's happening, but at the time it just sort of feels like this fun process. And so yes, the book is kind of in a way trying to capture that moment in time where there are a lot of chance elements, and you are kind of following your instincts, and relationship A doesn't work out, and you end up in relationship B, and then you're back in relationship A for a minute, and but suddenly the future is the seeds of the future are being planted, and that's certainly a major theme of the book, is trying to capture that moment in time.
Right, and your main character, a woman named Katie, and is it Content?
Content.
Yeah. Yes, I couldn't figure out how to pronounce her last name. Was it Content or Content? But and obviously there's a nice play there. Although her initials are KK, Katie Content with a K. But she, you know, you did choose a woman to write about. So in a way, you're able to take maybe a little more artistic license than if you were writing from a male point of view. It seems like, you know, a nice way to get out of yourself and take somebody else's perspective.
That's right, and I'm drawn to that. I think there are some authors who prefer to explore their own set of experiences as, in a very direct sense, as material for their writing. They gain artistic strength from reliving or relaying or going through their milieu. Or, you know, I think of Raymond Carver being a terrific example who writes fabulous stories, really drawing very intimately from the kinds of kitchen tables that he has sat at, the neighbors he has known, the day jobs that he had by the time he sat down to really write those stories. And I'm a sort of a different profile. I'm an artist who draws artistic energy from transposing myself, being in a different time or place or gender or ethnicity or social class or all of the above. I like to be imagining the set of experiences from a different angle, because I find that's productive for me.
Right. So here you're 70 years away from your, well, maybe not 70
my
years.
Material, yeah, but yeah, you're right.
But, in your own experience, let's say if you're growing up in the 60s, let's say.
The 70s.
Yeah. So yeah, you're a good 30 years away from the actual experiences that you're writing about. It's a woman instead of a man. But clearly you know New York. I mean, I think the book is just a gorgeous paean to New York in the late 30s, and I think you capture, wonderfully. And I think there is a universality, as you said, that this idea that New York is still or has been the source of energy and social drive for so many people. It's just a one, that setting is really important, I think.
Yep, no question.
But then the other thing that I thought was really interesting is that Katie, I usually don't like to talk too much about the story, but, to give it away for so people can enjoy it for themselves. But she does latch on to some very interesting people who are, she does not come from wealth. She comes from, a very, working class background,
right.
Immigrants, very, a common American story. But she gets connected to and seems very able to function well in a strata of society that is, way far from her early experience. So she's a very special person in some ways, that she's able to relate and has this tremendous verve and, intellectual capability to relate to and actually understand better than they do themselves some of the wealthier people with whom she associates, and kind of moves up a social ladder completely by accident. Everything is complex and not always the way it seems, but she has these great party events and, hangs out with, the well-to-do, and is really accepted by them just because she happens to be there.
I think that, and this again is something that happens today. We see it in our culture now. The better that one is an observer, and the sort of the bolder one is as a personality, one can kind of move through different social classes to some degree pretty fluidly. Not everybody's in a position to do that, clearly. But yes, she is someone who navigates the social classes pretty effectively, but sort of that moxie, as it were, is a big help for her in that regard. And she's a big reader, as it becomes clear in the book. She kind of reads everything, particularly fiction, excuse me. So it's kind of all a part of just sort of applying her imagination, but someone who's smart and articulate can tend to move through social, move up the social class at a little bit greater speed than someone who's hasn't had access to education, has not had a chance to sort of polish their behavior or what have you. So she definitely has an advantage in that regard.
Yeah, that seemed that she is a kind of, it has chameleon-like qualities, that she can turn herself to face whomever she's with and figure out a way of relating to them. So she's a very, she has a certain amount of fluidity in her ability to relate to people.
Sure. And I think that's true. I think that I like to think that what you just described can bring itself to being in very different kinds of personalities. That can be an aspect of a con man, and she's clearly not that. She's a person of integrity, but yet, as you say, can feel comfortable in different environments and relate to different people, but not as a means of for pursuing any kind of fraud, just as because she's connecting to sharp people through her own wit.
Right, and of course, and they like her. I think
That's it,
that
right.
was something I thought was pretty powerful, that she learns over time, probably doesn't realize, as when you're young, you don't know who you really are. You don't know how people take you. You don't understand your own effect on other people. So sometimes, or at least some people don't, maybe some people do, but she seems to come to understand kind of accidentally that other people are drawn to her. I don't think she realizes that at the beginning.
I think you're absolutely right. The book is definitely about her gaining confidence.
Yeah, well, no, it's about her becoming. I mean, in that way, that's sort of, you by picking out a year, I think it's, a kind of interesting, I don't know, compression again that she's gone through this. She goes, you just take that one year, so there could be, we don't know what else happens to her, but as we learn later, or at the beginning and then again later, that she actually has a pretty big life and does a lot of interesting things, but this is the year that acted as the lever to get her from who she was to being this the person that she will become.
That's exactly right.
And it is interesting. I mean, I also I do want to talk about the writing of this book. And I mean, the writing in the book is just beautiful.
Thank you.
I was there. I found myself picking out sections. My wife is reading at night, reading her own book, and here I am saying, "You wait, you have to listen to this. This is really beautifully written." And I'd read her a whole paragraph, completely out of context. But still, the writing in this book is amazingly good. Now, this is your first published novel. I take it, you're not you're not a novice writer, but maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got to this point as in your career as a writer.
Sure. You're right. It is my first published work, but I'm not a novice in the sense that I began writing as a kid, and I wrote fiction in college and graduate school, sort of a sea of short stories, as it were. And I'm in the investment business and have been for 20 years. And as I sort of began to make my way in that field in my mid-20s, I didn't write for about a decade. But then I set out to write a novel around 10 years ago, roughly, and I spent 7 years working on a book and concluded it, but didn't like the outcome. A book that was set in Russia and had a wide array of complex characters and et cetera, it did not work in the end. It didn't hold together, so I put it in a drawer and set out to take another crack at it, but you try to learn from your mistakes. That first effort was the first novel I'd written, and when you move from short stories to a novel, it obviously has a whole new set of challenges. The complexity of the shape, the duration of the storytelling, all these other factors. So in setting out to write a new book and looking at what went wrong in that first effort, one challenge of that first effort was that as someone who's a working professional with a wife and kids, I don't get a lot of hours upon hours to pursue my art over the course of the week. I get windows of time. And that book was designed where there were five main characters and the narrative voice changed each time you followed from one character to the next. And that's ended up being a very complicated structure given someone who's got limited time to write, because when you're pursuing a writing project like that, the way the tone of the word choice of the individual characters becomes extremely important. You're going from narrator to narrator to narrator, as it were, even if it's in the third person. You want the quality of the language to be changing over the course of that person's experiences, reflecting, how their mood is changing, how their insights are changing. So with five different characters, it ended up being that every time I sat down to work, I would spend 30 minutes trying to remember where I was. I mean, it just was not an easy task. So in setting out to do another book, I really decided, all right, I'm gonna have this built around a central character with a strong voice. In first person in this case, partly because so I'd always know where I was when I sat down. The first project I did not outline very carefully. or carefully enough. I didn't design the characters carefully enough. And as a result, I kind of went back to the beginning after 2 years. So in this case, I really decided I want to know everything that's going to happen virtually, but I want to have a very strong sense of the events. I kind of want to know where they're taking place and who the characters are before I set out to write, so I don't have to go back and start again. And that was a factor here too. But the final element was that in looking at that other project, I found that many of my favorite parts were the parts I had written in the first year and not touched, whereas some of the parts that drove me crazy were the parts I've been working on for 7 years. So I decided that in doing this project, if I did design it well enough in advance, I'd just give myself a year to write it, you know, once the outlining stage was done. And so I started the book on January 1st, 2006, and I wrote it over the course of that calendar year. It's not coincidentally, the book opens on New Year's Eve, and the book actually has 26 chapters, because there's 52 weeks in a year, and I wanted to give myself a week to draft a chapter, a week to edit it, and then I wanted to move on. That I didn't want to keep cycling back and tinkering with, you know, the first 50 pages and changing them and, you know, creating changes later. So I wanted to have a certain amount of momentum in the process. Now, I then spent 2.5 years revising everything. But yeah, the distance to this effort wasn't a short one.
No, obviously. But no, I think it's an interesting process that you describe. And of course, now I realize, you know, with 26 chapters, it makes perfect sense. Not only does it take place during a year and you've kind of compressed but it also, it's interesting that you wrote it in that way. Now, after you'd written the book, I mean, I assume that since you have a job and you have, you know, family, this is stolen time, essentially.
That's right.
Do you write every day? Do you write in the mornings before everybody else gets up? Or?
What I'll tend to do is I'll try to know that I've got, let's say, a 4-hour window on the weekend. And very often my wife might split that up where we'd all have breakfast together on a Saturday, and then I'd take the kids from breakfast till 1, and my wife would take the kids from 1 to 5, and we'd all get back together for dinner again. But that way I'd know that between 1 and 5 I would have a block of time, you know, at least 4 hours or 3 hours. But I know it was coming 5 days in advance and kind of work for everybody. And because of whatever, the kids enjoy it, you know, I get a little time with dad, a little time with mom. We all get time together. But so then what I would try to do is use the week, as it were, to plan the use of that 4 hours. I know I'm going to work on the chapter set at the racetrack, let's say, and I know that Katie's going to bump into so-and-so. So over the course of that week, I just start sketching it out. You know, what does it look like? What are the, you know, what's the language of that chapter? What are the themes? What are the conversation like? Who's there? You know, do I change any of my thoughts about the plot at that moment? So that when I did sit down, ideally you have a series of ideas you're excited to develop, as opposed to kind of that blank page staring at you and, you know, as the clock is ticking.
Right. No, I think that's interesting, because that is a structured kind of organized way to make the time work. I suspect that you're somewhat unusual, that you have some organizational talent in you that enables you to do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been like that when I was 25. But yeah, it's the necessities of my profession, of being a parent, you know, that you start to you live a little bit more by the hours in the day, you know, as you age, in a way that I think as a kid you certainly don't. I mean, or as a 20-year-old, you avoid living like that.
To do this novel set in New York, 1938, did you have to do research on, I mean, even, you know, some of the events that occurred, as you said, racetrack, or there was, you know, there's a party in Long Island. I mean, those are things that you may or may not necessarily know about just by chance, you know, by living
right.
your life. Did you have to, you know, kind of delve deeper into the historical period so that you had these kind of in your bones so that you could write about them naturally?
I didn't do any applied research for the book. I love the period, and as a student of culture over 20 years, I've dwelled in the period in different ways. I've certainly watched the movies of the 30s. I know the music of the 20s and 30s. I knew the art movements well. I certainly knew the fiction of the time. It was a very terrific and interesting cultural period in American arts and letters for sure, but globally too, or at least in the West. And so I really have a strong affinity for the period. So when I sat down to write the book, I decided, all right, I'm gonna draw on that kind of secondhand sort of feel for the times, and invent from there. And at the end, I went back and made an effort to fact check. Not in a, there's always something that slips through. I get an email, every now and then, somebody saying, that nobody, would have driven over that bridge to go to that place or whatever.
Right.
So it's not perfect. But nonetheless, I did go back and fact check, where you just want to double check, that, was the Williamsburg Bridge even built then? I think it was, but it might have been built at the end of the Depression. And I went back and just double checked some of that stuff. And but yeah, mostly it's an effort to kind of invent from a foundation of kind of a voyeuristic knowledge as opposed to research. And actually, if you go, it's not a sales pitch because my website's for free or whatever, but at amatrolls.com, one of the things I put up was a map of the city with nine of the key locations in the book, with histories of those locations. And four out of the nine are factual places, and that's the actual history of those locations. And five of them are made up, and the histories are made up. So, that's part of the fun for it for me too, is taking, trying to create a nightclub that feels like it must have been a historical place, but to have it be entirely invented. I mean, that's part of the fun of the process.
Right, and that's, it isn't necessary for, I mean, it's a novel, so it doesn't have to be faithful in every single detail, but you want it to be faithful in kind of spiritual, in a spiritual way, in a, in a kind of feeling that you could have been in that place. And of course, I think I love the 20s and 30s too. I think that it's a period of, I think very modern. And I felt like your main characters were all very modern. They could have been us today, just the setting was different, and the literal details of what happened to them is different. But clearly, there's a certain a thread of modernism there, that I think makes that period really sympathetic to people, or should make it people sympathetic to people today. And I, it's interesting to kind of imagine, I think one of the things that happens is because we've watched movies from the 1930s, they're all in black and white. It's very difficult, I think, to imagine that life in color, which I think a novel can do
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
better than a film. But I thought you did actually kind of, I'm not searching for the word, but I think you kind of transported us effective, really well into that year, into that period. So, from hopefully it'll encourage people to, maybe read some history of that period, because it is really an interesting, I think people, when they hear the word depression, they think of the Depression, they just think everyone was depressed, everyone was unhappy. And the late 30s were kind of the beginning of the end of the Depression. And it's, what you're showing is that, people's lives went on, that even when times were hard, there was a lot
Yeah,
of.
well, I wouldn't be the first to observe it, but the Depression was an important heyday of the Broadway musical of Cole Porter and those guys, of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, of the Marx Brothers. You if you didn't know the what period of time that came from, none of those things, Cole Porter, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, the Marx Brothers, as you say, a heavy foreboding to them, a sense of depression. They have a great lightness, in some cases, sense of luxury and madcapness, and as I say, I'm not the first to observe that's one of the American responses to the Depression culturally, was rather than, sort of in the German Expressionism, grappling with the challenges of early 20th century Germany by painting these, very
Right.
difficult, unsettling paintings with an unsettling style. the American cultural response was kind of the opposite. Was, you know, we're going to lose ourselves into some of these glamorous elements. And when the populace showed an interest for that, the artistic community responded in kind, with a terrific generation of invention of these forms that are quite, as I say, fun and upbeat, and, you know, swing music being another example, you know, which was zipping right through the Depression. And if you listened to swing and you came from another planet, it would never occur to you that that music was the byproduct of a terrible time for a nation economically. So yeah, that is kind of an oddity of the times.
Well, it's overall, I think it's a terrific novel, and you know, I'm hopeful that you're. Well, I guess this is the next question that it's sort of inevitable to ask, since you've written and won. What are you going to do next?
Well, I'll start another book, hopefully at the beginning of this coming year, that I'm designing right now, and you know, I'm looking forward to writing it.
Is it set in a, I mean, I don't want to, you know, pin you down, but is it?
It is set in a different time and place, yeah. I'll tell you that much.
All right, that's good. Well, no, you don't want to repeat yourself. I think that's probably, now, do you find that having done this and having had some success and people telling you, I hope people are telling you this is a great book, do you feel, I mean, does that, I don't want to, you know, does that make you feel like a little, like you have, like it's harder to figure out what to do next, or does it make it easier?
I kind of decided what I was going to do next beforehand, so I haven't kind of let myself rethink that. I actually, to tell you the truth, I think it would be, if the book had bombed, that would have been harder. You know, I mean, if the book had bombed, you start to rethink, what am I doing? Am I doing the right thing? And what are my strengths and weaknesses? Should I be doing it at all?
I wish you luck with the next novel. I think it's, you know, if this one's any sign, the next one ought to be great.
Well, so. I'm cross my fingers. Thank you.
but it's been a pleasure talking to you, Amor. And I want to recommend this book to anybody who's listening. I think if you only want to read one novel this year, you should read Rules of Civility. It's a terrific book.
Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Amor. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast, and I've been talking to Amor Towles, author of Rules of Civility.